This is my 75th SQL Saturday as a presenter, so I'm kind of Mr. SQL Saturday. I really enjoy mentoring and watching the light bulb go on when people, you know, learn something new and important. Contact information, don't worry about taking notes, the slide deck, and all the samples, which are all self-contained or operate off of public data sets such as AdventureWorks, will be available for download on the SQL Saturday website, the schedule page. If you've been there may already be some sessions that have an orange download button. And whether you go to the session or not, it's free content. And you can go to the main SQL Saturday page. There's a button that says View All Events. And you can see the over 200 SQL Saturdays that have occurred so far and open up their schedule pages, and anything you see that's of interest to you is freely, with the orange download button, is free content. And it's one of the best resources, I think, on the web for learning. Some very smart people have put up a lot of good material there. Unfortunately, you can't, like, search all of the ones that have happened by keyword or whatever. I keep asking them for that enhancement, and maybe they'll put that out there sometime. I think one of the main pass objectives for the portfolio owner, the director that owns the SQL Saturday thing, is a refresh of the SQL Saturday website, and hopefully they'll have the ability to do a search to find, you know, I want stuff on reporting services, and there's, you know, 19 sessions on that topic. So that seems cocky. If you were in my last session, pardon me for going through the same spiel again, but I have now 45,000 man hours almost in just the SQL Server relational engine. I don't do analysis services. I couldn't Oracle anything or MySQL. I do a little bit of .NET, but it's almost all the engine and a lot of tuning related work. I've been an independent consultant. I started my company in 99 and did independent consulting through third parties for 3 years before that, and started with DBase when DOS windows were the way we interacted with things. So long time dealing with data. I'm not a BI person, but I know a lot of good BI people. So if you need one of those, I can make a referral. So we'll talk about why the windowing functions are important, what they are. We'll cover quite a number of classes of queries that we can do, and there's a lot of query patterns that can be solved or enhanced through the windowing functions, and especially the new enhancements that we have to it. Changes to the over clause, which has been available since SQL 2005, right, with the row underscore number function that allowed us to do a lot of really cool things very efficiently in some cases. We've got a lot of enhancements and additional things that we can do on top of the over and within it as well. First and last value, we'll take a close look at a very common design pattern or query pattern, which is a running total. And almost every client I've been at in 15 years or so of consulting has had one or more needs for a running total. And they can be grotesquely inefficient if you do them the set-based way in SQL Server before the 2012 windowing functions are available. Lag and lead, and then some new analytic functions as well. If you have any questions, please jump up or raise your hand and ask, and we'll see if we can get to them. If not, I may defer some. I only have 60 minutes, and I like to have 75 for this session. But we'll have time afterwards. I don't have any other sessions today, so feel free to come and take some time with me. They allow for really straightforward and, in a lot of cases, much cleaner, easier to understand code, and they're often very, very efficient. Not necessarily always the fastest for all queries or all query patterns, though. And as you can see, a short list of a lot of things you can do with them. The over clause determines the partitioning of data, if you wish. It's sometimes required, sometimes optional. And the ordering of the data while you're processing or doing some action on that stream of data that goes through it. And the really interesting thing is that I wish I had a whiteboard, but I typically think of the rows of data that are coming, and they're just marching in a line. And somewhere along here is what I will call a read head. And that read head is at the current row. And that's, we're doing something in relation to the current row that's there. And there's things that have preceded that row, and there's things that are following that row. And as we'll see, our windowing clause and frame stuff always uses that metaphor of a stream of data and a read head doing something current row, following, preceding. Okay? And I have some really good graphics that are on a blog post by Fabiano Amorim that will really, I hope, help to gel the visual and make your brain really understand how the data is actually processed. So again, the square brackets in the, you know, the definition, language definition parlance means optional. So we have an optional partition by clause, and I like to think of that as bucketizing the data. We put it into buckets, like we have a bucket that's client ID, or month, or year, or patient last name, something like that. We're putting the data, and within those buckets, they must always be contiguous and grouped together. If we don't explicitly do a partition, there is always a partition. It is one, and it is all the set of all data. We have an optional order by clause, and the order by occurs within each partition. So if you're doing it by client ID, you'll have client ID 1, say, and within that, it will be ordered by something, perhaps more than one thing. And then when you hit another partition, client ID 2, you'll start another ordering set of that partition of data. Okay. And now the new stuff, optional, is a row or range clause. And that is what is known as the window frame itself. So we can further identify or subgroup, if you will, specify the data within what we've already got, partition, order, and how do we further restrict or categorize the data. Okay. So it is done within the range, within the partition and within the order by, and you can either do it by logical association, which is the range clause, which is A, limited in what you can actually do with it. Remember, this is in 2012, it is a version 1.0 release. And just like your company, if you make product or code, your version 1.0 probably isn't feature complete with all the things you want to do with it ever. And you probably had to cut some things out and maybe cut some corners on performance. And that's another big thing. The performance of range is very, very poor. And we'll see some examples of that. The other is physical association, and that's the rows clause. And we can say, again, in relation to our current row, do 10 rows before and 10 rows after. And that's a specific association of physical number of rows with relation to the current row. So, and again, what it does is it just further limits. Like I said, if we're streaming the data through and we have a read head and we say unbounded preceding to current row, that means everything that's come before up to where I'm at right now. And then operate the thing that's before the over clause, say a sum or an average, right, on that particular window frame. Or 10 rows before and 10 rows after. Okay, so again, range, as we'll see, is a very poor performer. So we have some new keywords, right, that can say all the things that have come before, unbounded preceding, a physical number preceding, current row, unbounded following, all the things that have come after or will come after me, right, and a specific number, and then a between, which just like the t-SQL normal between is inclusive of the endpoints, between minus 10 and plus 10. So we're in AdventureWorks 2012, and there's usually a new flavor of AdventureWorks released, freely downloadable from codeplex.com with each major release of SQL Server. So there's, five or six different variants out there now. So we will use Profiler, and I have a very standard restricted set that I use for tuning, which is RPC completed, statement completed, and just a minimum number of fields to know how much work is done and then to be able to order and do some analysis on that, such as start time, SPID, and database ID. Okay. This is very, very efficient, and if you do it to disk, it has almost no overhead at all. Okay. You can run Profiler. I mean, there is a Profiler running, you may not know this, 24/7 on all of your SQL servers by default. So don't say that we can't do Profiler because it kills performance. If you do it on the GUI, it can. especially on the same server. And if you do it with the really bad thing called statement completed, then it can crush you, especially if you have cursors or scalar UDFs, multi-statement table valued functions, things like that. So be careful with that. So hopefully you're familiar with AdventureWorks, and we've got a employee type table, and here's stuff that we've had since 2005, right? Row number 1 to N, maybe partitioned, maybe ordered. In this case, we are partitioning by job title, and we're ordering by business entity ID, which is the ubiquitous identity 1-1 that everyone seems to put on every table, whether they need it or not. And if we look at the query plan, we see the biggest cost is the sort, which is required because we do an order by, right? So always, I see so many queries at clients where I've actually been to some where almost every select statement has an order by. Because when they were doing developing it, you know, humans like to see order, so they would order it. And also it helps sometimes with data validation to make sure you don't have gaps or you whatever. In production, that's very costly, right? So only order if you really, really need it, right? Because as you can see, that's the most costly thing here. And it's a 1 to N. And if we look at accounts receivable specialist, you can see that it goes from 242, 3 and 4, and orders 1 to 2, 3. And then it hits another bucket, the job title, starts from 1 again, repeats until the end of the set. Now, we could also do aggregates on that. So that shows us the total number of rows for every output row that goes through, right, which is unfortunate. It's a little data bloat there. If this were a stored procedure, I might prefer to send that one value out as an output parameter instead of every row with the output set itself, right? Much more efficient that way. But in this case, we'll see what we have to do now is a double hit on the table where we read it once and the segment, sequence, project, all that's all optimization or engine operators to fulfill the row number. And you can see there's a second hit with a lazy spool that does the count and spits it out with every row that comes along. Okay. So now we can also do aggregates with the over clause itself. And now we're going to specify ordering by the entity business entity ID. And if we hit F5 instead of the key 5, we'll see if you count from 1 to N ordered by the business entity ID, it's actually the same thing as a row number, because it goes from 1 to N as well. And we hit the first row, and the first count is 1. To the second row, we've counted 2 rows now that we've seen. So as the rows go by, we simply add another tick to our count bucket. Right? So now counts moving with the current row. And that applies to any aggregate scenario here. And obviously, we can now also partition. And now our count will go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, whatever, for each bucket of job title that spools by. And we can see here the count and the row number go in lockstep per bucket. And again, it doesn't just have to be the count function. So partitioned ordered aggregates is what we're able to do now. And with that alone, no other thing added, there's a bewildering array of data analysis that you can now do and questions you can ask of your data to efficiently answer. So we'll create a table of sales. And again, don't worry about the details. It's a sale date and a sale amount. You'll be able to play with this at your leisure. We have territories and some sale amounts in another table. And we will get the sales date, the current sales, and we'll format the sale amount divided by the sum aggregate of the sale. And note the format is another new thing in SQL 2012, T-SQL enhancement. It provides or exposes the .NET flavored format command. If you've done .NET programming, there's a whole bunch of things you can put right there to say, I want it to be a dollar sign, I want it to have a leading three leading zeros and 4 trailing zeros, I want it to be percent or currency, all kinds of things. CLR based, under the covers, don't have to enable CLR, kind of like hierarchy and spatial data types. But it's not very efficient, right? Formatting should be done where? Not on SQL Server. Because that's RAM, CPU, IO, whatever that you're burning on a very precious resource. So move it out somewhere other than SQL Server. Best is on the client side, right? If you want to make something look like, have a leading dollar, do it in JavaScript or Ajax or whatever, or some grid control on their website or their web page on their machine, right? So very, very important to do that. Now, again, max per territory, and we can see here's territory one. Note, we're partitioning by territory ID. So they always have to be grouped together when you partition by. So for territory one, I have four values, and you can clearly see that that is the max, and it gets carried for each bucket or partition. You hit a new bucket, it resets. For all the rows that come by, it says, are you higher than what I have so far? Yes, add, put me in the new spot. When you get all the rows out, then you can actually spit it out, right? You can't actually release this set of rows until you've read all of territory one, right? So it has to store those, and sometimes that act of keeping track of things until we can release it, because we know we've seen all the rows, can get a bit costly sometimes if you have very, very large numbers of rows, or especially if you're using the range clause. So running totals, just a quick example of that. The classic way of doing it somehow involves comparing one thing, usually a date, to all the dates that are equal to or prior to it, because you need a running total says all the things that come before, add them up and put them out with this row. And every row that comes by, you have to do that. So it's quadratic performance degradation. And if we run that, we can see 33 page IOs there. Note, I ran it twice. This is a key thing when you're tuning. Don't tune the first run, because you're tuning, then you're seeing the cost of compilation as well. And you can see it's not a small amount when you have small queries, especially. If you're running a big data warehouse query, the cost of compilation is nothing. But if you're running a query that costs 0.002, the cost of compilation actually adds up. So we can also now do it as a running total like this. And now the first row, the running total is that. This row is this number plus that number. And this row is that number plus that number. So we add all the stuff. Actually, it's that plus these. Those three are that. And it gets really, really slow. 94. Well, this stuff's supposed to be faster, right? But remember, range is poorly performing. And just for a very, very few rows, you can already see an order of magnitude difference between the range default and even the old less than or equal to set-based mechanism. So we'll see what happens when we have more rows. Questions so far? So first and last value. I really like it when a language or code is declarative. If I see first underscore value, I'm pretty sure I know what that's going to be doing, right? And that's a good thing, right? And it literally does spit out the first value or the last value within the set. Now, a key thing here, and we saw this in the running totals, the default is range between unbounded preceding and current row. One reason that was picked is that it guarantees that no matter what you've done thus far with row underscore number, you are guaranteed to get exactly the same output when you move to 2012. And obviously they had to do that. They couldn't break all prior code by making some, you know, change to the over clause that made all the old code break, right? So it will give you the same answer. Every row underscore number that you have in existence now will work and give you the same answer in 2012. But unfortunately, the performance of this, it does a lot of disk activity, physical disk activity, that the rows clause does not. And they just didn't have enough man hours to do the tuning for that. So last value, scalar expression. That's a pretty open-ended statement there, right? A lot of things evaluate to a scalar in T-SQL. Right? Often it's a field in a table, column in a table, but it doesn't have to be. Optional partition by and a mandatory order by clause. Okay, It really is easier to understand, and typically you do self-joins, subqueries, things like that to get first and last value in others. And it can often be much more efficient, but not necessarily always. And the first and last row must be in the actual output set that you're going to get. You can't make it so that a row that would be there somehow gets weeded out. The engine will not allow that. So here's one of the graphics from Fabian Amrim's Simple Talk blog post. He has a series of three posts covering the windowing functions. One was first done when row underscore number came out in 2005, and then two follow-ups with the newer stuff. So we're doing order ID, customer ID, first value of the order ID, and we're partitioning by customer, so we group an order by that. And within that partition, we're ordering by order ID. And good, always be fully declarative in your code. Don't leave things default to, because you may not remember what the default was 3 months later. Or the person who comes after you and has to debug or fix your code or tune it may not know what the defaults are. Or they have to waste time and go look them up. Right? So even if you're using fully default stuff, explicitly put them in your code. Then everybody knows when they look at it what's what. So we're being declarative here. Rows, performance, between unbounded preceding and current row as first order ID. And we're filtering for customers 1 and 2. So as the data streams through, we hit this first row. It's 10643. And our window is one row. It's 10643. We have no unbounded preceding, and our current row is the current row. So that is our window, and there's our pointer to the current row. That goes by. Now it is a preceding row. We have a following row we haven't seen yet. And now it pops under the read head. And our window now expands to be two rows in size, with our current row being here. And the engine has stored for us in a little memory spot the first value it got. And obviously, in this case, it doesn't need to replace that value at all, because the first value for that whole set of customer ID 1 is the first row it came to. But it puts it in memory, and it might need to change that. And we'll see in last value, obviously, it does. And as we go through the rows, our window gets bigger. And if you can visualize this, then what you actually do here, you can know what's going to happen with the set of data that is unbounded preceding and current row. This is a really good way to look at it. Now, when we hit the end, up to here, we haven't sent a single row out yet. We had to store them because we haven't hit, until we hit the end of the partition or the end of the data set altogether, we can't put a row out because we don't know what our ending set is yet, right? Now, the optimizer in this case probably has been coded to know, for first value, you can go ahead and spit them all out because I'm never going to see another value that other than the first value that came by. But in other cases, a lot of this stuff has to be stored with the whole set of data until it can release once a partition is over, okay? When it hits a partition, spits it out, resets all the counters and pointers and whatnot, and we start again 10308 to 10308 and grow from there. Questions? Now, last value is a little bit different. And one thing you need to think of is, remember what the default is, rows between unbounded preceding and current row. What's the last value you see if the range between unbounded preceding and current row? It's the current row. Right? You haven't waited for the last row in the set, i.e. unbounded following. Without that, you get the wrong answer if you leave defaults. And I'll have an example to show that. But in this case, what happens with the frame, the first row we get through, really, we have current row and no actual frame yet. The frame isn't really this big yet. It's going to get that big because it has to encompass all data before and all data after. And the current row moves down, and at this point, when this row goes through the read head, right, when that gets processed, at that point, the last underscore value is 10692 in the little memory bucket that's set aside to store the last value. When I see another value, I replace 10692 with 10702. And my pointer moves down, and I wind up with a frame that looks like that. hit the bucket partition end, spit them out, reset, and start with the next partition. Questions on that? Really important for understanding how the data is going to get processed under the covers. So let's take a look at that example. So in earlier editions, we could do a select of a select, I like to call it. Top one business entity ID, order by business entity ID. So get the first one and spit it out with every row. First one is one, and it spits out one for all 290 rows, as expected. Double hit on the table, again with another lazy spool to track that first value, and so it can spit it out with every row that streams by it. Okay, so two hits on the table. And I will tell you that as a tuner, I always look for opportunities to trade CPU ticks for I.O., and that's one thing that the windowing functions typically allow us to do. And we'll see some pretty complex examples that hit the data once and then do all kinds of stuff with it while it's sitting in memory. Okay, so here we've actually now, let me show the code. Oh, down here. So now what we've done is we've correlated the inner select to the outer. And now it's grouping. And our accounts receivable specialist, 242, 3, and 4. And you can see 242 is repeated for each bucket. And we get the right answer. Row number. Now we'll create a CTE, comma table expression, code that we can reuse within that same statement. Row number, so it's going to go from 1 to N, order by business entity ID. But to get the first one, we have to join the CTE to itself on row B, row number equal 1. Give me the first one and spit it out over and over again with every row that streams by. And that's obviously a double hit on the table as well, with a pretty X because we don't have a join criteria. Okay. We can group it also, right, with adding a partition in the over clause of the row number, and it will go from 1 to N. So now, again, joining on row number equal 1. So for this, there were actually three rows computed, and it would be row ID 1, row ID 2, row ID 3. 242 has row ID 1. We joined the table to row ID equal 1 of the CT itself, and we get the repeated value. And if we look at what we can do with 2012, I mean, that's just clearly simpler code, right? And you know exactly what you're going to get out of that. And you actually get it. Most importantly, we have a single hit on the table. One pass of data. And that can be all the difference in the world. We can also group first value, simply put a partition by in the over clause. Okay, 242 carries over for the three. We reset the bucket to the next one. Okay, questions? Now, if we look at that again, and this is default everything, which is range, unbounded preceding to current row. Page reads. Now, bucketizing with the row number was 30. That's almost two orders of magnitude less efficient than what we had available to us in 2005, 8, and 8R2. It's really, really inefficient, because the default range is a poor performer. If we explicitly specify, which we should always do, we should always, whatever it is, even if it's range, explicitly specify it. And in this case, prefer to use rows if you can. Unbounded preceding and current row. So we get the same data, unless there's a bug. And in this case, the performance difference is astounding. And that's a really small set of data. Very small. Questions? Last value. Well, to do last value in the old way, I mean, all we had to do for any all of these queries is to simply reverse the order. And we get 290. We get 290, right? We can bucketize them. So remember what I said about the default will give you bad data? Well, the last value is 290. We saw that from two other pieces of code. So why is it moving in lockstep? Remember, unbounded preceding to current row. I'm operating on unbounded preceding to current row, and I want the last row, last value of that set. The last value is clearly my current row because I don't have anything following it yet, and I've restricted my data set to not include that. So we must do unbounded following to get the last row within the set. Never forget that one. Questions on that? And again, there's just lots of permutations you can do for all those unbounded preceding, number following, number preceding, current row. The sky's the limit. Okay, it's left to your creativity to decide how you want to write your query and what might be more efficient than another one for certain data access patterns. Okay, questions? Yep. Mm-hmm. If it's poor performing doesn't mean that you get the wrong answer. So, I mean, you know, it's not going to hurt you to use one that's slow unless it hurts you for your stuff to be slow, right? And that I would expect over time, hopefully, the performance of range would be improved as newer versions or additions or service packs or whatever are released. It's just important to know coming into it that if you leave the defaults, it's not going to be as efficient as it probably could be. So that's the key. Get the right answer, and then tune. And one of the things you can do to tune is switch from rows to range, potentially. And here. So running totals, very, very common class of problems. And well-known SQL MVP, Aaron Bertrand, he put a very nice post up on SQLServerPerformance.com. He works for SQL Sentry now as like a evangelist for them. He took, I think he presented seven different mechanisms for doing running totals in T-SQL. And he actually left one out, which is you can do it with a cross-apply. That's very interesting as well. The classic set-based mechanism, again, is somehow comparing a current row to all the rows that came before it, which is in this case the less than or equal to on the date. And he has a self-contained demo that I actually include in this. You'll get it, I encourage you to go look at his blog on this. That does a 10,000 row set of data, and this particular set of code is quadratic performance degradation. So as the number rows go up, it doesn't linearly get slower. It goes up like this square of the number of rows. And for that 10,000 row set, that caused 50,005,000 rows of data to be processed. It's stunningly inefficient. And I've actually come to clients that have had queries that would run reports like at end of quarter, end of year, whatever, that would take more than 24 hours to process. Just spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. Grabbing all the rows that came before, next row, all the rows that came before, next row. It's just stunningly inefficient. So you could also rewrite it as a select of a select. In this case, we're wrapping it in a coalesce, which is a CPU burner, because we simply don't want to see nulls out, so we replace those with a zero. But again, we have to compare the current row. We have to aggregate all the things that came before. And on 10,000 row set, that one's doubly bad. Now it's just a shade under 50 million twice. So the set-based processing for this and a number of other things that you can do, some gaps and islands and things like that, are just horribly, horribly inefficient. And cursors, as bad as they are in SQL Server, and they're really bad, especially compared to some other RDBMS systems, right, that are can be highly optimized for row-by-row processing. Cursor solution that he did with his benchmarking was way more efficient than the set-based solution, because set-based is quadratic performance degradation. Cursor is linear. Each row of process takes a finite number of CPU ticks, and you simply multiply the CPU ticks times the number of rows, and that's basically what you're going to get for the duration and the effort. There's some other mechanisms. You can do it with a CTE on the date. There's windowed range, right? Remember, that's not very efficient, but it's still way more efficient than the classic set-based solution. Now, the quirky update, if you're a fan of SQLServerCentral.com, which I am, I do a lot of forum posts on there. There's a gentleman, Jeff Moden, kind of started out. I think he was the one that came up with a way to take a set of data and update it in a mechanism that if you abide by, I think there's five different rules, specifically making sure that rows are processed in a specific order, you can do things like running totals very, very efficiently. Some very smart people, there's a couple of posts on that forum that have hundreds of posts, and some very smart people, Paul White, Florian Reichel, Adam Mechanic, myself, a number of others, really beat against it to try to say, can we break it? And we kept finding ways, like parallelism. If you have parallelism, you don't necessarily process the rows in order, and you can get the wrong answer. So, but Microsoft doesn't support this. They don't guarantee that you will always get the right answer. So be careful with that. But it's really very, very interesting. The final one, the window with the rows clause, was so efficient. He was using a SQL Sentry tool to capture the metrics, and he would do 10 runs, average. I think he dropped off the highest, fastest and slowest, and then averaged the rest. It was so fast that the mechanism wouldn't capture the execution. So he had to put a wait for 1 second delay, because instead of running in 60 seconds, 60,000 milliseconds, it ran in 40 milliseconds to process the same set of data. That's 0.004. So like 6 orders of magnitude for just 10,000 rows. And remember, it's quadratic. If you have a 500 million row fact table you try to do that on, you can't buy big enough hardware, right? You just can't. Let's take a look at some of the code. We won't go through it in a lot of detail, but remember, you'll be able to download this, and I really encourage you to look at this. Look at Profiler, look at the query plans, see what's really going on, because there's some very interesting code here. So he creates a database, and he populates the data with some speeding tickets, the date it occurred, and the number of tickets on each day, right? And puts 10,000 rows in, and then has a number of different ways that you can do this. Cursor, obviously in a cursor, you keep track of where you're at now in a bucket to store all the running totals. And if you needed to partition them, you'd have to keep track of the current ID or date and the previous date and do interesting things about that to partition them. Note on the cursor, if you do cursor-based programming, you should declare them almost always to be that. Hugo Cornelis actually did some benchmarking that showed that that is faster even than fast underscore forward for the majority of cursors out there. So static forward only, read only, local. So you do a cursor and you simply rip through the data. Right. And remember, that's a minimum of an 8K fetch every row. And that sends your page reads through the roof, which is why they're very inefficient. I did not want to do that. So that's the cursors. Date CTE, so we have a with, the date, and this is recursive. They can be really inefficient, and you can blow things up, so you got to be careful with them. But in this case, it's much more efficient than the set-based solution. Inner joints, these guys are just horribly bad, right? Anytime you have that, it's not going to be good for you. Let's look at one of the other ones. The quirky update. Here we go. So we put all the rows. So we'd put 10,000 rows into basically a holding table. And then we update the holding table, and check this out. We set a variable equal to a column equal to a variable plus the column. That's really kind of cool. But if you don't follow all the rules, you will get bad data. Okay, if you allow parallelism, if you don't have a clustered index on the order that you need, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but it's very interesting, and there's other classes of problems you can solve with that. And there's a lot of people out there that use it. Subquery, and then we'll look down here at our Windows range. Note, the example is not fully declarative. I would like to see an and current row there. And same thing for here. I would like to see rows unbounded preceding and current row, fully declarative. Questions? I encourage you to really play around with these. And then there's another one that Peter Larson has that has cross-apply as another mechanism for doing running totals. That's a very interesting and rather efficient solution as well. Okay. Questions on that? Let's see how we're doing for time. 19 minutes. Lag and lead. Again, also very appropriately named commands. Lag, something that comes behind, and lead is something that's ahead of. And that's exactly what they are. And it's really interesting because you can access data from rows that you haven't even seen yet. Or rows that came some number of 100 rows back. And you can reference their data. So now you can do comparative analytics in a single pass on the data. Classic case is a lot of financials reporting, right? What's the current quarter versus quarter year ago? Lag minus 4 on based on quarter. So no Windows frames here because you don't really need them because you literally explicitly say, go there, get that value, and spit it out with this row. Or go there and spit it out with this row. So lag, scalar expression, again, pretty open-ended. Optional offset, be declarative. Put the default of 1 in if you intend it to be 1 row, which is the default. Default is something, think of a case where you want to lag 4, right? You want to get 4 rows ago, and you're on the first row, right? Stream comes through, hit the first row, give me 4 rows. I don't have 4 rows that have already come by, right? What are you going to get back? A null, right? Same thing if you left join and there's no data there. Well, if there's no data, when you ask for data, you get a row or a value, and that value is going to be null. And sometimes on reports, we don't want to show some vice president this word N-U-L-L. They don't know what that means. Their head will explode. So we put a 0 there so they can, have a good day. Or empty string, that's the other thing, is null, my field, comma, tick mark, parentheses, right? Offset and default. No window frame, you just say, go there and get me the row and come back. It really is easy to read and understand. You don't have to do self-joins and correlated subqueries and all that kind of stuff. Now again, the row has to be there. When you get it, you can't filter it out. And I believe we have an example of that. And you can't use that in the filter for the where clause, but you can put a CTE and then filter from the CTE. So pretty straightforward T-SQL coding there. Lag and lead. VentureWorks 2012, again. So correlated subquery. Give me the minimum of customer or my customer ID is before the customer ID that I'm on now. From customer, order by customer ID. So, the next one, the biggest one that's greater than me is 2. Or excuse me, the smallest one that's greater than me. 2, the next one's 3. 3, the next one's 4. that's a big fat double hit on the table. Yuck. With a stream aggregate in there for the cost. Row number, order by customer ID, 1 to N. Join the CT to itself, row number minus 1. Okay. And 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, yada yada. Query plan, double hit with the sequence project in it. Yucky. Although, sometimes that's all you gotta do. But look how bad that guy is. The old 2000 mechanism. Because remember, every time we hit, go check all of them that came before me again. Anytime you got that triangular join, the less than or less than or equal to, or greater than greater or equal to, it's not going to be happy. This is pretty efficient, right? That's pretty good. But I think we can do better. And we can certainly have cleaner code. Right? I'm hitting the table once. And that's going to be a good thing for me. See, we're starting to get fairly complicated here. Segment, sequence project, compute scaler, segment, window spool, that's new. Stream aggregate, spit it out, 19,820 rows. One hit on the data. And in this case, there's not even a sort because the clustered index is in the order that I want. And the engine and optimizer know that. So it doesn't have to put in that very expensive, sometimes sort. And Itzhak Ben Gann wrote a book like SQL Server 2012 High Performance Windowing Functions, something like that. It's about half inch thick. It's one of the few books I have in my SQL Server library. If you're going to do stuff with these, first thing you want to do is go to Amazon or wherever and make a copy, a purchase of that book. And he has a term called a POC index, partition, order, covering. And if you have that, then your windowing functions are going to be as fast as they can possibly be. Because it doesn't have to sort, doesn't have to partition to, it doesn't have to sort to do the partition, it doesn't have to sort to do the order by, and it doesn't have to go to the base data table doing lookups or a clustered index scan because you've covered all of the columns that you have in your particular query. And that's as fast as it can get. That's not to say that they can't still be very efficient with even if you have to do the sort. Now note here, still a good bit more efficient. And if you look at the reads, that's essentially the whole table, right? Because we had to hit it twice before, and now we hit it once. So lead one, where customer ID is one, right? I get a null, which is not what I want to see there. I've filtered out what is the next row by saying customer ID equal 1. So in this case, I have to wrap a CTE and then specify. And unfortunately, in order to get the right answer, I still have to hit all the data in this particular query pattern. But if we do it with other mechanisms, well, that's a big fat one. We don't like that one either. But if I do it this way, now it's very, very efficient. So know your data access and your data access options, and you can come up with queries that are significantly more. That's an order of magnitude for a very small table. Okay. So don't use new and shiny just because it's new and shiny. I make a lot of money off of developers who immediately jump to whatever the latest and greatest thing is, like Entity Framework 1.0, anyone? Entity Framework 2.0, anyone? In Hibernate, whatever. So those are getting better, the ORMs. But the early editions were devastatingly bad. And they get arbitrarily complex. So we're lagging the rate for a pay history table, partition by business entity, order by rate change date. We're doing a rate comparative, right? We're using the format to do a percentage. All kinds of cool stuff. So they started out with this salary. They must have some pictures of somebody doing something they weren't supposed to because they got a huge raise, right? 175% increase in that pay action. So, but again, we're doing comparative analytics, all that stuff in a single hit on the data. Trade CPU ticks for I/O. That's pretty cool stuff. So gaps and islands you can do. I mean, there's, if you think about this case, so here we've got values 1, 2, and 3. Then we're missing 4 through 9, and we start with 10 through 15 as a sequence. Gaps and islands, very common data solution, data problem. And we can do gaps and islands 4 to 9, 16 through 65 in a single pass through the table. There's a lot of very interesting solutions to these. Itzik has written a number of articles on SQL Mag. Some others have come up with some very interesting solutions there. Questions? Okay. Analytic and statistical. I'm not a statistician. I did speak at one event I did with this with a PhD statistician to try to understand a little bit more about some of this stuff. But companies with all the, quote, big data stuff and data analytics and data scientists and all this stuff, companies are really finally starting to realize that if they use their data for stuff other than just placing orders and doing inventory and purchasing stuff and paying salaries, they can extract actionable intelligence and knowledge and information out of the data if they do deeper analytics or any analytics on it. And some of these mathematical and statistical functions can allow you to do that within T-SQL, within the engine. Instead of having to pull out a set of data and running it into SPSS or SAS or R or some of the other mechanisms that are out there. So cumulative distribution is a distribution from 0 to 1 of the values within the entire set. And again, you can partition if you want, optional, but you must order by, okay? Because the value must be in relation to where it's at in the stream of the entire set with a specific order. Percent rank is very similar to that, 0 to 1, the relative rank of data within the ordered, mandatory ordered set of either the entire stream of data or the partition, with each partition being a segment, if you will. Percentile discrete. It computes the percentage value of the row with relation to the entire set or the partition. And if the computed mathematical value is not in the set of data that it's operating on, it will move the value to the nearest actual value within the set of data. And if they're equidistant, the rule says that you will move it to the next lower value that's actually within the set. And the PhD statistician said there are reasons why that it's important to do it and move it to the next lower one, as opposed to the one that we'll see next. So we have numeric literal, that's pretty open-ended. Within groups, some new T-SQL keywords and phrases here, order by expression. And then we have this is interesting, the order by is within group, the over has the optional partition by. So the syntax gets a little clumsy, I would like to call it, because you have two different sets here, and they're not standardized with the rest of the T-SQL. Now, this is the one that's different. You calculate the same value with any ordered set. So if we want the 30th percentile, we'll take the partition of data, ordered by whatever it's ordered by, mathematically compute the 30th number within that set. At this time, though, we don't move it to the next closest number that is in the set. We simply output that mathematical calculation. Okay. So, again, it is computed. It's an exact or approximate set, and we'll take a look at a demo, and some of this will hopefully make a little more sense, and you'll be able to think of some cases where you might be able to use it. Analytical functions. So now we're in TempDB. So every time you run this, you'll hop over to my server and run it on my TempDB. We have a student grades, test ID, student ID, and some grades. Note there must be some extra credit because it can go up to 119 or 119.9999 for a score. Actually, it's an int, so only 119. And then we insert some data into the table. And now we'll do the cumulative distribution, partition by test ID, so group the tests together, and then order them by grade, lowest to highest, as percent of people scoring less than or equal to me. A very wordy but appropriately named column. And then when I use the format command to make it a percentage, it's the percent of people scoring less than or equal to me formatted. Okay. So within the first test, two people scored a 59, and that's an eighth of all rows. They're equal to each other, so they got the same value of 12.5% of all test scores for test one. And it goes up from there. Most people scored less than the people that scored 99. Only one person didn't. And obviously, since there's none greater than 100, 100% of the people scored less than or equal to the person getting the highest score in the set. Rank. So we'll have a table, numbers 1 to n, integer, no gaps. Percent rank, order by number. So 1 to n. And the rank within the set is shown as simply a decimal type value. A lot of times this will be multiplied by 100 to get you some percentage, right, of the rows that are less than that number. Now here's where we look at the discrete and the continuous percentile. 50th percentile, which can actually help you do things, interesting computations to get medians and modes and stuff like that. And note they're different. So why are they different? Anybody remember? The discrete value must be in the set of data. The mathematical 50th percent, if you take these numbers and add them together and divide them by the number of numbers, it's 5.50000. That isn't in the input set. And it moves it to the one that's closest. Well, there's two that's closest, and the rule says if there are two that are equidistant, you move it to the lower value. So that's why we get 5. If we have some more rows in the table, then it changes the output to 7.000, and they're equal. Okay. Hopefully, you or some people at your company are good with statistics and know what they can do to make use of this. I, unfortunately, do not. Okay. But as you can see, they can get fairly complicated with partitions and groups and things like that. And sometimes the numbers equal each other, and sometimes they don't. See, like here, the mathematical calculation is within the set, so you get the same value. And when they're not, you get a value that is a little bit less than that. So there's a couple links here. Remember, Fabian Imrim has 3 different blog posts on the windowing functions. There's a link to Aaron Bertrand's Running Totals blog post. I do have all of his code, that sample is in here for you to use, but you probably will want to go to what he's got. And I've got just enough time to show you something that really interesting that I did for a client that is a Web 2.0 mobile platform application company. And if you think about the case where you want to do session-based analytics, right? Like how many times did a user open a particular app on their phone? Or how long did they interact with it? Or what things did they do while they were in it? Or what's the average use of an app by all users of that app for a certain period of time? Well, what you have for that type of situation is not the classic, I started now, I did some stuff, and I ended my use now, right? Because when you're using a phone or a web page, you don't typically say, I'm done with this right now. You just put your phone in your hip or your purse or pocket or whatever, and that's it. You just stop using it. But you don't send a record to the system to say, I stopped using it right now. Some period of time goes by and you pull your phone back out and you open up the same app. That time could be 2 seconds because you lost where you're at and you want to go back to Google Maps. Or it could be 20 days or a year or never. And you have to be able to say within the usage that happened, if a certain gap goes by, I want that to be the end of the previous session and start a new session of usage for my analytics. So here's some things that I had to do to come up with all of that the analytics for that. I had to first compute the end of each session by saying, if a gap of more than 15 minutes occurred, then terminate the previous usage and start a new one. And any activity within 15 minutes becomes a single use session. Lead, over, partitioned, subquery, case, lag, date diff, partition, over, order, lead. All to come out with hit, one session, two sessions. Start, end. For each user, for each application on this platform. And millions of rows per day. But that's not really, that just gets me to the point where I can start doing analytics. But what I really want to do is say, how many usages were there and what were like the average duration that each session went? And lots and lots and lots of operations here, right? Let's look at the plan for that. Here's the table over here. And there's 27 operations in a single pass through the data to do the analytics, and very, very, very efficient. Okay? So they really can do some amazing things, and the sky is the limit for what you can do. Any questions? Finish up. Sorry, I ran a few minutes over. Thank you, and I hope you have a great rest of the SQL Saturday.